welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 621, and it's the BSB show after a tiny hiatus with me, Andrew Corse, and joining me shortly will be new boy at school, Mr. Dave Neal. This week, we're going to be covering round 10 of the Bennetts British Superbike Championship, and that'll be the first round of the showdown, which was a couple of weeks ago at the TT Circuit in Assen, and just this weekend, round 11 back at the UK at Donington. And Mr. Dave Neal was there. Dave, how are you doing this evening?
Andy, good evening. How are you, mate?
Good. Like I say, how was those new boy shoes?
I tell you what, after 14 years in the same company and then going somewhere where you know absolutely nobody is quite a daunting, experience. Fortunately, Jennifer had done me a really good pack up. She'd polished my boots, sewn my name into the back of my into the back of my jumper and my t-shirt.
You had your plimsolls in your PE bag and everything you needed.
Yeah. I've got my mittens on elastic that go up and down each sleeve. So, you know,
Scott Redding lunch.
I'm ready for everything. Ready for everything.
Fantastic.
How's life in Switzerland, mate? All good?
Yeah, we're still enjoying some pretty clement weather, some nice blue sky, about 20 degrees here, considering, you know, we're into October now. I mean, the leaves are changing. Fall is definitely coming, but right now I was out walking the dog this morning enjoying some pretty good sunshine. So, yeah.
Wonderful.
All good.
I like it. And we've got quite a bit to cover, really, haven't we? Because logistically, we missed Donington Park through logistics. Building up to me coming back to work. And then Donington Park coming around really quickly.
Yep. I think it was Assen that we missed.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, it was Assen that we missed, not Donington.
Yeah, and there was some good racing.
Getting ahead of myself.
There was some good racing to be had at Assen. Probably, I mean, it's a pretty legendary circuit. It always throws up some good MotoGP. It's throwing up some good Superbike. I think this year as well, there was definitely some good racing and a few different names in the mix as well, which we'll get onto in a minute. But let's rip through some news. Before I get, some of this is kind of old news, some of this is new news, some of this is just news, but I think before we get onto it, I think, you know, we should probably just take a minute to talk about Johnny Ray, 5 times now World Superbike Championship after sealing the deal at Manicor. We haven't really been covering a lot of World Superbike this year on Motorpod, but a pretty impressive season considering where he started, you know, when you think back to Australia.
Yeah, Bautista came into the series with an absolute bang, didn't he, on the new Panigale V4R. And it was almost as if Johnny Ray was never going to get a chance to win another race, almost. The Bautista Ducati mix was imperious. And did he win the first 11 races on the bounce?
Yeah, it was something like that. And I think
something along those lines, which I know they're running 3 races a weekend, which makes it slightly easier than previously. But overall, to turn around, I think it was 121 points and win the championship. For me, the actual turning point was Laguna Seca, where Bautista DNF'd all 3 races and injured his shoulder. And from then on, I think Johnny Ray has just obliterated the competition.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty, like you say, it was a pretty imperious start. And it was a little bit misleading too, because I think Kawasaki at the beginning of the year with their new bike as well, you know, we thought that there would be a lot of consistency. We thought that they would just continue on their winning form. But I think they didn't have that bike perfectly dialed in. I think we saw in some of the other series where the riders were getting to grips with the 2019 Kawasaki, there was definitely, you know, some throttle issues and some other things I heard that took him a while to get dialed in. But yeah, Bautista's pace from the outset was huge. And I think there was definitely that point in time where we're thinking like, well, he's literally done enough to win now. There's no pressure on him. He can just sit back and start, you know, picking up seconds and thirds or whatever. And that would pretty much be enough, even if Johnny Ray did start winning. But then I know that the pressure or the expectations seem to get to him because you mentioned Laguna Seca, and I agree. I mean, that was really where the wheels totally came off. But I think we saw, if it was Jerez before that, where like the, you know, that seemed to be sort of the where the pressure got to him, and it cracked a little bit.
He did. And then I think that really did set the tone then for Laguna Seca not too long after it.
Yeah.
Because it became mistake after mistake after mistake. And in true War of the Worlds style, suddenly his head fell off. And it just, he never got that back. And he was earning a huge amount of money in bonuses for finishing on the podium, winning races and everything else. It, I think he was almost on the verge of semi-bankrupt in Ducati because his bonus levels were so high. And it just, after that, not even a sniff. Has he even been on the podium since? I can't remember. Because he struggled at Donington as well, didn't he? Yeah, well, he the did crash take, in on yeah, the Saturday. No,
I mean, he took two wins at in Spain at Jerez, and he was back on the podium in Italy for both those races.
You're doing really well at this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry. And I guess he did take a win at Portugal.
Okay. At Portimão.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't see the coverage of that, so that's probably a good reason why I didn't know.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, once, you know, Johnny found his form, I mean, well, I mean, even when at the beginning when he was quote-unquote struggling, I mean, he was still taking second places.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah. He was still racking the points up just in case.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, even his first three rounds of, what, Phillip Island, Buriram, Argentina, and Assen, you know, it's pretty much all seconds. And then he starts at Imola where he gets, you know, his first wins. And then there's quite a streak from Misano through Donington into Laguna as well.
I mean, fair play to his mental strength for that.
But it's still, I mean, I think, you know, you could still see from the quality of his riding, it was a pretty impressive and dominant run.
Absolutely it was. But it also shows up, on a slightly negative side, that there still isn't an awful lot of competition for Jonathan Rea. Because I know that on occasion, the Yamahas have challenged for podium positions, and they've been strong early in a race. The same with Tom on the BMW. But overall, Chaz hasn't been where he should be.
Leon Chaz took a long time to get going with that Ducati.
Yeah.
I mean, his results came in, you know, especially at Laguna, which obviously is a good track for him.
It's always been a good track for him, though, hasn't it?
Yeah. And you're right. Yamahas are the only ones who seemingly be able to consistently sort of be there or thereabouts. Even, you know, Johnny Ray's teammate, Leon Haslam, which is no slouch on a Kawasaki, you know, he didn't exactly have, I think from his expectation, a stellar season either.
Which is shown today in today's news, hasn't it?
Yeah, which does lead into the news that he will be leaving KRT. Still no real news as to where he might end up. I think Kawasaki, with which he has a strong relationship, is maybe keen to put him into the Pichetti team or elsewhere if they end up running two bikes. But there's also been some rumours that he may be coming back to BSB. Do you know any more?
There are a ridiculous amount of rumours concerning Leon Haslam over British superbikes.
And Leon Cameo?
Leon Cameo also. It seems that the two Leons are looking for the same ride.
Yeah.
To replace Scott Redding at PBM. There's also rumours that they may run three bikes at FS3 because they've picked up the baton of official Kawasaki team from Pete Exton's Bournemouth Kawasaki. He's rolling back his efforts next year because he's opening a new dealership in Hampshire, I believe in Southampton, as to match his super successful Bournemouth Kawasaki outfit. So there was rumours of that. There's rumours that Pete Exton's might run him in a one-man team. Literally, it's... There are rumours abound, and as you say, Pichetti Kawasaki was another one. Obviously, for Leon, he'd like to stay in World Superbikes, but for me, I think he'll end up back in British Superbikes somewhere. Whether he'll end up with Birdie on a Ducati, he's still a contracted Kawasaki rider for another year as a factory rider. So, whether they would put him into FS3. They've only confirmed Danny Buchan so far. My expectations are that Lee Jackson would be stepping up to that next spot. From what I'd read on Twitter, around the time that Danny Buchan re-signed for FS3 for the third season now, Jacko put something up on Twitter as well to the lines of, it's been a really good day today. And it was the same day that Buchan signed. So putting two and two together, I believe that Lee Jackson will get the second seat at FS3. I don't believe they'll run three bikes, because it's just a nightmare to run three superbikes. It didn't work for GB Moto when Leon Haslam came back, when they ran James Ellison and Peter Hickman a couple of three seasons ago. So it's an unusual shout. It depends what happens with Leon Camier as well. There's rumours of him staying in World Superbikes, whether there's a role for him at Altea Honda, whether he stays out there, or whether indeed he does come back to British Superbike. We'll wait and see. There's been a massive amount of rumours over Donington Park weekend. Nobody knows what to believe at the moment, but the strong rumour at the moment is that Leon Haslam will sign for Paul Bird Motorsport.
You know, this year has been interesting, having a big brand name like Scott Redding come back into the BSP paddock. I think there's been a lot of attention, a lot of press, a lot of focus, and I think PBM obviously has benefited from that.
Seriously, yeah.
No doubt it was quite a big financial investment bringing Scott here, and we know that PBM have lost their Bewiser sponsor.
Yes.
Logically, I would expect them to be able to line up someone of a similar caliber going forward into the next years as well. So, yeah, I'm curious to see which way they decide to go, because I think sometimes there's some way that's, you know, you can either look locally and take what you think will be the up and coming next rider talent.
I just don't think Birdie will do that.
Go with something which is a bit more headline brand name.
He wants his bikes first and second on the grid,
yeah.
On the podium. It's been mentioned that Ryan Vickers has been touted for that ride. Roger Burnett, his manager, former British champion, GP rider, TT rider, etc., and Lincolnshire resident up in the Wolds, the hilly bit that Lincolnshire does have hills. anybody who's been to Cadwell Park will know that. Not just my part that's really, really flat. He's been touting Ryan around the paddock a little bit more, but he's been trying for the PBM ride. But as far as I'm led to believe, Paul Bird wants another name in that seat, akin to Scott Redding, so which would lead to a World Superbike rider coming back into the fold. As far as I'm aware, it won't be Alex Lowes. He's going to replace Leon Haslam. It's kind of the
correct.
Worst.
That's what I understand.
It's kind of the worst kept secret in the World Superbike paddock, that Toprak was going to Yamaha and Alex Lowes was going to Kawasaki. It's a massive amount of guesswork and whys and wherefores, and do you mind if I don't? So it's all speculation. There's nothing confirmed yet. Certainly not that I've heard. It's just all rumour, and there was one after another at Donington Park over the weekend.
Yeah, I'll bet. I think as we walk through the news here, we can definitely see that I think a few different teams were sort of interviewing and trialling different riders potentially ahead of next year's season. Before Assen, we had the news that Glenn Irwin had parted company with a Tyco BMW. From what I understand, I think that was Glenn wanting to do Rhodes and BSB, and
yes.
Obviously the Tyco team not wanting to do the Rhodes. Glenn, I think, could have benefited still from a little bit more time on that bike. I think he was getting pretty good results from the off, if you compare to his teammate Iden, who'd been riding the bike for majority of the year. I think, you know, he still could have done well for the remaining seasons, but I guess Tyco wanted that opportunity to audition some other riders.
Yeah, I mean, obviously from what we've heard, Glenn is Honda way to another team, further down the pit lane. So he's out there. The Tyco team drafted in Taylor McKenzie this weekend, who actually gave a really good account of himself. Unfortunately, he didn't get to race because of an incident in the Stock 1000 race, but through free practice and qualifying, he really held himself up well. I'm not convinced he's a superbike rider, but as usual, I know cock all, and I'm quite happy to have my opinions changed, the same way that Danny Buchan did. He's doing a similar thing, and he's tried it. It hasn't worked. He's gone back to stock. He's trying it again with a stronger team. He came up. Who did Taylor come up with the first time? He came up with WD-40, didn't he? Mm-hmm. Did a season with them.
Yeah.
Moved to Moto Rapido Ducati, but unfortunately parted company halfway through last season with them. He just could not make the Panigale twin work for him, which was when Tommy Bridewell was drafted. Correct. In after, yep. Snetterton. So he's done a great job this weekend. So yeah, there are a couple of auditions going about. The whereabouts of Bradley Ray are yet to be confirmed, as with Luke Stapleford as well, who will come to at Assen. There is a potential that Build Base at the moment could lose both their riders.
Yeah, and I remember for Assen, I think Richard Cooper got a superbike ride, didn't he?
Yes, he did, because the stocks don't go there. It was a free weekend for him.
Yeah.
And after winning the Superstock Championship, it was a nice thank you for him.
Yeah. And a trial as well, just to see how he'd go, I imagine, on the superbike as well.
I would hope so, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah. Well, and so I'm just trying to think too, what else there was. OMG as well. They had some announcements, I remember too. So part of that was that they were moving away from the Suzukis to the BMWs for 2020 season.
Indeed.
And I think they confirmed Luke Mossy for 2020 as well.
They have.
For Assen, Josh Yeller, unfortunately, was replaced by James Ellison.
He was, yeah. Lived and breathed that from Cadwell, unfortunately, trying to put something in place to try and fix that relationship. We tried on behalf of the team and of Josh, and unfortunately, it didn't come to anything. For the breakdown of communication, there was no one massive thing that caused that. It was just a breakdown in communication between what the crew chief and the team were after, and what Josh and his circle were after. They just could not agree on a way forward for Josh. So unfortunately, as it came to, they built his bike ready for Assen. But unfortunately, he couldn't bring in someone to help him out in time. So the ride wasn't there. The bike was ready, but he didn't have the crew to help him out. And it's ended going on from that story that was released prior to Donington Park, that finally Josh and OMG have agreed that the season is done. Josh is still a contracted OMG racing rider, and until such time, I don't think the team will hold him to his contract. If he found a ride for Brands, I suspect the team would say, you know, off you go, no problem. Most of the riders, I think, are contracted until usually, I think, either the November, 31st of October or the Monday after the final round. So it's a sad way to end it after starting the season on such a high. But they just never reached those the joys of race winning, or even sort of trouble in the top 10, unfortunately. So a sad end to the relationship between Josh Elliott and OMG Racing.
Yeah. What else? Gino Rea. There we go, OMG. He was back on the MV, I think, after Assen for the last two rounds, starting from Donington.
Yes, very much so.
And we also had Taylor McKenzie back at Tyco BMW for Donington as well.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Did I not just go through that?
It was a very expansive piece of coverage.
You mean because you fell asleep because of my wafflings?
I normally listen to you when the podcast comes out. That's when he actually listened to it.
You don't even listen to me when you're editing it. I just listen to the show when it goes out. Then I go back and listen to what you said.
Okay, well, how about you didn't say anything about the Santander Salt Tag Team confirming Super Sport champion Jack Kennedy for 2020, did you?
I didn't, but I knew it was coming.
Alongside Dan Linfoot.
Indeed. Good choice, that, I think.
Yeah, that was good to see. I'm happy to see Dan will stay with them and they'll get the 2020 R1s. As well. Yeah, Jack Kennedy, second year in a row now?
Yeah, double Super Sport champion, yeah, for Integro Apple Yard McAdam Racing. I think it's a good choice. I mean, as much as Sean Winfield is an awful lot quicker than me, Sean Winfield isn't quite quick enough for BSB. He has respectable lap times, no doubt, no question at all, but they're akin to Superstock lap times. And with his dad owning the team, there was always a little bit of, you know, like nepotism is alive and well. The guy can ride, don't get me wrong, but he was a long way back from the main runners and the sort of, he was never going to trouble the points, really.
Yeah, and I think for any other rider in a team who wants to be competitive, you want a strong teammate. You
of course.
Want someone who you can potentially share data with. You want someone who's going to push you, who's going to motivate you, who's potentially going to show you, you know, different ways to ride the bike or set up the bike.
Yeah, and Sean can't do that with Dan.
And if you don't have that, then you're sort of on your own a little bit with the direction and with the setup a little bit, and arguably, you know, even with the motivation as well.
I agree completely. And I was listening to a rival podcast. No, they're not rivals, really. They're not a bad bunch of boys, really. I listened to Chasing the Racing on the way over here yesterday, and they have Pete Hickman on, and he was saying the same thing of trying to develop the bike at Smith's when he's either been on his own. He wanted James Ellison in to try and raise the bar to develop the bike as well, which failed miserably. And now he has Alex Olsen in, who's a complete rookie to the series. So it is quite important to have a relatively strong teammate to be able to take the development of the motorcycle forward and to push you into going faster. So yeah, it's going to be good. I mean, Jack's ridden the superbike before. I'm sure he rode for Brent Gladwin at WD-40 for a season before he went back to Supersport. So that would be obviously three seasons ago, whichever way you look at it. Not last season, the season before. Mm-hmm. So he has superbike experience, but with the tag team and what Josh Brooks did with that bike, it proves that they have the potential. They just need Dan and Jack to work together just to break into that top 10 on a regular basis. Dan's been putting some fantastic performances in qualifying over the year. But for whatever reason, the races just haven't fallen right for him. So it would be nice to see him take that forward into 2020 and start being a regular top 8, top 6 rider, which we know he's capable of. He knows his way around the circuits and he'll have had a year's experience on an R1 anyway. So it'd be interesting to see what they both do, for sure.
Yeah, agreed. So we're going to have to cast the minds back a little bit, and we'll just run through Assen. I'm just trying to think. The points going in really for Assen were Josh Brooks leading the showdown there, had 3 points ahead of Scott Rudding in second, Tommy Bridewell in third, a slightly more distant 24 points behind. Also, don't forget there's the Riders' Cup as well, so we're also looking at the 7th, 8th and 9th place riders, Andrew Irwin at that point, Xavi Forrest and Christian Iden as well, to see who could have a good event. For sure, after coming from some of the more typical UK Nadgeri tracks, this was going to be an event that Scott Redding was likely to fancy his chances at, a big open sweeping MotoGP track that he's been at a few times as well. So, you know, you got to think he was likely to be on the top step at some point, but also Josh Brooks as well on that Ducati, a bike highly likely to go well at a fast sweeping track like Assen.
Without a doubt. And if anybody had any doubts whatsoever about the credibility of Scott Redding on the PBMB Wiser Ducati, Assen just rammed that home completely. I struggle to remember. I'm sure it maybe is more recent than I can recall, but I'm struggling to remember the last time a rider went P1 in every single session, including warm-up.
Yeah, he was on it right from the get-go. I mean, he had the confidence, I think, from that comes from, I think, you know, mastering, you know, these completely foreign tracks to him, these really, really tiny tracks. He's had enough time with the bike now, I think, to get confident with that. And, you know, when he turns up at Assen, he knows where he's going. He knows how to go fast. So he was just going to absolutely let rip. And he did.
Absolutely. And it was really impressive to watch. The racing was fabulous. And also there were a couple of interlopers as well. Jason O'Halloran found some form at last after having work on his shoulder. The McCams Yamaha man trying to rescue something from what's been a fairly difficult season for the Aussie. And also Luke Stapleford, he of British Supersport Championship fame and World Supersport. He knows the circuit really well. He's always gone very, very well there. And they seem to have found something with the Build Bay Suzuki that weekend. And he was a consistent thorn in the side of the top four.
Yeah, absolutely. Stapleford was somebody who really came to the fore, like you say, putting his World Supersport knowledge into place. Some people who didn't do so well, unfortunately, was Tara McKenzie. He was hoping to have a good weekend. He seemed to struggle, and from what I understand, they had some real issues. They spent a lot of time trying to dial in some settings until they figured out that, in actual fact, the bike was slightly bent from a previous crash.
It was, yeah.
They fixed that, straightened that out, but he'd lost a lot of setup time, and unfortunately, they only put him, 15th, I think, on the grid after qualifying?
Yeah, he'd literally lost the whole of Friday once they realised that the frame was bent and they had to strip it down and rebuild it.
Someone else who went well as well, I thought, was, we've mentioned him before, Ryan Vickers. I think he was 7th in qualifying, having never ridden at Assen.
Yeah, he is consistently inconsistent. However, he does show flashes of outright speed. And for a kid in his first year on a superbike, he's doing okay. It's bitten him a couple of times, which we expected. And it's not dinting his confidence too much. But I still think he could do with another year with that team rather than going to somewhere like Birdie and being chewed up and spat out with the pressure.
Yeah. I think race one was pretty good, but race two, I think, was the better race of the weekend. Race one was the Ducatis of Redding and Bridewell out front until, unfortunately, Bridewell pushed a little bit too much and crashed out. Pretty innocent little crash. I don't think the bike was too badly damaged. And then the rest of it was a three-way battle for the podium between Brooks O'Halloran and Stapleford, with, unfortunately, Stapleford just losing out for the podium, taking fourth.
I think the hardest thing about Tommy Bridewell's crash was Christian Idden barreling in the background and nearly taking out a couple of the Orange Army at the same time. But everybody was away unscathed. He didn't actually tag anybody, which was great.
And then, like I say, race two, I think, was kind of the better race by this time. A lot of people had that extra race setup time to get the bike dialed in. And, you know, as we know, Assen always throws up some great race. But this one really did come down to a great little scrap toward the end.
It did. Scott had already buggered off into the near future, which left Tommy Bridewell, Danny Buchan, Josh Brooks, and not latterly, but certainly mid-race, Luke Stapleford was making a nuisance of himself once again, which was really good to see. Luke's he's a good little rider, and I expect to see him back in the championship in 2020. But yeah, it was who was going to lose out, who was going to need the points. Josh Brooks needed the points to close the gap on Scott, who had, if he was 3 points behind going in, was 2 points ahead going into race two. Which then became 7 points after the win. Bridewell, Buchan and Brooks separated by half a second at the line. Just 0.2 separating Bridewell and Buchan, and then 0.3 for Josh Brooks. Josh Brooks, just that for me, potentially has cost him the championship.
Yeah, I think it was always going to be a bit of an ask for him to beat Scott at Assen.
But he had to do it.
I kind of expected that. So I think for me, the bigger round for Josh was going to be Donington.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, if you go back to Donington on the national circuit back in May, on the late May bank holiday weekend, Scott Redding did the double. So you knew he was going to go well, even at the GP circuit. But winning the two, doing the double at Assen has really put his tail up. And that's going to be really hard to pull back.
Yeah. And that's why I thought Donington was important for Josh. I think he needed
to It was important. There's no doubt about
it. Just to sort of blunt that, like you say, that confidence.
And I don't think there's anything out there at the moment apart from... Do you know what? There is something that blunts Scott Redding's confidence. Rain. Rain on Pirelli tyres, he is not confident with at all. When we talk about Donington, you'll see that. Because he doesn't know, because there's not been that many wet races this year in British. There's been wet sessions, but I don't recall many wet races.
And I think I remember, though, I'm fairly sure that Scott has taken some opportunities to get out in those wet sessions to get used to the Pirelli rain tyres.
Oh, he has, but it's not enough to race in them. Race on them, sorry. And the one race that he could have done...
Well, then let's talk about Donington then, because I think this could be interesting, because we might be heading for a slight difference of opinion here.
Go for it.
So, well, yeah, like you mentioned, unfortunately, the Donington weather wasn't necessarily the best. Qualifying was, no huge surprise, I think, with PBM riders leading. But the Suzukis seemed to fare fairly well with Bradley Ray and Luke Mossy showing some good pace.
Sure. And I don't know what they've done to those Suzukis, but it's working. Whatever it is, with Brad Ray in third place and Luke Stapleford in sixth. That was fabulous. But it was a Herculean effort of a lap from Scott Redding to snatch pole position from Josh Brooks. By what was it? What we're looking
point four.
By a good 0.4 of a second,
yeah.
Which in BSB qualifying terms is quite a distance.
And I think it's pretty impressive too. I mean, what interesting if you have a look, it's Ducati, Suzuki, BMW of Christian Iden, and the Suzuki of Luke Stapleford, the Ducati of Tommy Bridewell. So Tommy there, a little bit further down maybe, perhaps. They
just didn't nail the setup this weekend.
Yeah, yeah.
Not, and certainly not in free practice and qualifying. Yeah. Hickey through to Q3 was good. And Taylor McKenzie, there we go, into Q3 at his first attempt this season aboard the Tyco BMW, ahead of his brother.
Yeah, and it was the two Yamahas, just behind him.
Which is a dreadful result for them,
And Danny Buchan, the first Kawasaki... 13th.
Which I can't explain.
Yeah, isn't that surprising? Well, we'll talk about Danny.
And the two factory Hondas behind him.
Again, I think this is maybe because on Friday it was wet, and therefore they didn't get a lot of dry running time, and therefore not a lot of setup time as well. So there's a bit of a sort of making it up on the hoop.
There was.
They went through
Friday
qualifying,
was...
and I think we can see that some of these people got it dialed in through race one into race two.
I think it was still quite damp on Saturday morning for FP3. But it was certainly cold and windy. Friday was pretty much a write-off, with mainly it expecting to be dreadful weather on the Sunday. The weather forecast was for something quite incredibly inclement as a rain front passed through. Every weather app that was available said that it was just going to hammer it down on Sunday, pretty much until mid-afternoon. Thankfully, when we woke up on Sunday morning, there was no rain. The ground was wet, the roads were wet, but I don't think, until mid-afternoon during the MotoStar race, I don't think it rained again. So both of the Superbike races were dry, thankfully. I think the MotoStar race had a bit of a shower around it, but other than that, the wind was fairly strong and it stayed away. I know there was a little bit of mental rain in race one.
Yeah, I think it was race one.
Yeah, race one.
Just toward the end.
Yeah,
and this
towards
is maybe,
the end.
This is because I was wondering if this is what you were talking about. As race one got underway, unfortunately, Taylor McKenzie, after that great qualifying effort, didn't get to take part. He had a big crash in the Superstock race.
He did.
Earlier in the day, so he didn't get to start. Lap three, we saw a bit of drama as Bradley Ray came out onto the main straight. Had a little bit of a slide in the rear, just snapped, and for some reason the rear brake caliper fell off.
Which just shouldn't happen.
I know. I found that like startling and amazing. It took him a while to figure out what was dangling and bangling around underneath the bike. I was really worried that at some point it was going to loop up and get caught, in the rear wheel there. But unfortunately, with all the TV coverage covering that and all the slow-mo replays and everything, we didn't actually get to see Redding's pass on Brooks for the lead.
But then he got a little bit duffed up then by Christian Iden, didn't he?
Well, yeah,
and then dropped to fourth.
Yeah, coming down Craner curves, I think he had a bit of a moment that allowed Iden to kind of get underneath him, which set him up a little bit. And then that also allowed, I think, Bridewell and then Hickman as well with a bit more momentum to come through. So he went from sort of like first to fourth, fifth there.
And
he,
coming down
Craner
curves. I think
he did say after the race he did seem to struggle with that bike on a full fuel tank.
He did. But just as I mentioned, coming down Craner curves wistfully takes me back to Wednesday morning.
Oh yes, we actually got you out on a bike. Do tell us about that. Where was my manners? And not at all.
That. I was going to come to it during the Donington anyway, yeah. Because when the guys at home listen to the interviews at the end of the show, we have Sean Neary and we have Keith Farmer that I'm grateful for joining us. Sean Neary contests the Ducati Tri Options Cup. And obviously Keith Farmer is out injured at the moment after his big smash at Knock Hill aboard the Tyco BMW. But you'll hear in the Sean Neary interview, it's audio, but in your mind's eye, you'll see the look on his face when I explain to him what I'm about to tell you. Bearing in mind, I've not been on a bike for 3.5 years. And the last time I was on a bike, I just did one session before I crashed at Coppice.
I think the last bike you were on, it had a bell, didn't it?
There is that, and I wore a tutu. Yeah, exactly that. First session was terrible. First time I'd ever ridden a 1,000cc machine. And quick shifter, auto blip, all the whistles and bells. First session, my grandma could have rode around better, and sadly, she died years ago. second session was improved. They told me I was on with a guy called Ben Shuttlewood, who is a road racer. He does the Manx, he does Scarborough, places like that, and explained to me, this is what you need to do. I want you in this gear here. I need you to change, close your braking and off the throttle. None of this coasting malarkey. Anyway, long story short, we got down to a 206, which I was really chuffed with. And you'll see Sean Neary's face in your mind's eye with his response when I ask him, did he go faster than a 206? Because that's me setting the benchmark for the weekend. His face was an absolute picture. I said the same thing to Chrissy Rouse as we were chatting on Saturday. And he was like, what, in the wet? I went, no, in the dry. I said, do you go faster than a 206? And he's like, I don't understand. What? He just couldn't get his head around it. I said, no, it was my best on Wednesday. Surely you haven't gone any faster than that. And then he ended up winning the race. Congratulations, Chrissy, by the way, on your first Stock 1000 victory.
I saw that as well. That was great news. To see from Chrissy Rouse, took that as well. So, yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, what would they be doing, like...
133s.
33s, yeah.
And I think the Ducatis are, I think Sean said 130, 137, 138, something like that. I can't remember what he said. You guys that are listening, you'll hear it later on. But you can just picture his face. It was so funny. I was so, so proud of my lap time. And once I'd cleaned the flies off the back of my helmet and we put the sundial away to time the lap, it was all in all a really good day, which I have to thank Express Coffee for Chris and Tristan and Owen, his boys. Brilliant day out. Absolutely brilliant. If anybody out there hasn't done Ron Haslam Race School yet, go and do it next season. It's fabulous.
Yeah, I had a good time. I did a few years ago when they were just temporarily at Silverstone.
Sure.
I got to play with Dave Johnson, who was an absolute hoot, absolute screamer. I did the 600s in the morning, which you had to do at that point to then go on to do the 1000s in the afternoon.
Yes.
But yeah, it was an absolute scream working one-on-one with Dave Johnson. And my abiding memory of that is him just on the back wheel down the entire straight. With his little fluoro bib thing flapping in the wind. Just hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
The guy, as was unfortunately, there were faster guys than me on circuit on the elites. And I can't remember who the instructor was. It might have been Kyle Wilkes, actually, who I've known for a lot of years. One of the first guys I interviewed when we started Paddock Chatter. He went through Stock 6 and Stock Thou. Super rider, but a super, super nice guy as well. As we're going through Schwantz, the left-hander, before you drop to McLean's, the right-hander, he's cranked over and he's just dragging his glove on the floor, his left hand, minding his own business. But it spooked his pupil. He did that. He leaned over, he's dragging his glove on the floor. His pupil immediately sat up and shortcutted the whole of McLean's. When we got back into the debrief room, this guy was like, I thought you'd lost it. I didn't know what to do. But the amount of talent that these riders have, that these guys have going around there, it beggars belief. You know, riders of yours and at your level, you know, guys, super fast guys on track days, and it beggars belief. I'm in complete awe of anybody who can and ride any Donington at anything less than a 150.
Yeah, but you know, you think you're pushing, and then, like I say, you know, you're following Dave or any one of the other one of the professional riders, and you know, they're not even breaking a sweat; they're just out having fun. But yeah, it was a great day. Really enjoyed it, and I think you know they provide everything there: the leathers,
yeah,
the helmet, the boots,
do, yeah,
if you need it, including the bike as well. The bikes normally, from what I remember, had data logging.
Yes, they do
on it as well, so they can really quickly sort of narrow down. Or figure out, you know, where you're having issues, where, you know, what's contributing to
everywhere and
back.
Everything.
And, yeah. So it's good fun.
But that's 3.5 years off, so I'm just blaming rustiness. Anyway, we digress. We digress.
Yeah. Well, the next thing then is to get you out on a track day, I think.
No, I need a reference point. I need an instructor.
We'll sort you out. We'll sort you out. Okay, maybe next year. Next year.
Maybe next year. Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So when we left it, we were talking about race one.
Sorry.
At Donington. Yeah. So we were just talking about the fact that, you know, although Brooks unfortunately had kind of, initially got the lead, you know, Redding put a pass on him, then he just pretty much scampered off. Well, everyone else just chasing him. So it was a bit of a processional race, unfortunately. I mean, you know, Reading had a bit of a big gap on Bridewell. And I guess the battle was sort of... Actually, the battle, to be honest, was like further down the grid. But we didn't really get to see much of that on the TV coverage, you know, which is kind of that sort of mid-pack of like Andrew Irwin, Forrest Buchan, Ryan Vickers.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't get to see much of that necessarily. So yeah, it was a bit slow until we got to, you know, toward the end where you had Inn, unfortunately, losing a foot peg, on the left side, which is the gear change size. And then, like, you know, he had no chance. I mean, how are you meant to change gear without a foot peg?
Absolutely.
Or hang on to a superbike? I've no idea.
Luckily, it happened so late in the race that, yeah, unfortunately, you know, it took a podium position out. He was running third at the time, which pushed, which kept Josh Brooks down into fourth place. Josh was gifted third place there, which would have been 2 fourth places on the bounce for him, would have done his championship no good whatsoever. But yeah, I mean, Christian did superbly well to even bring it home in sixth place. Such was the gap to the riders behind the guys at the front. It turned into another Ducati lockout on the podium. One thing that is interesting, that, as we said, there were spots of rain, and it does seem to spook Scott Redding.
Well, so that's your interpretation, but I that was not my interpretation.
Go for it.
So, like, he's leading the race. He's confidently got the pace. I think he was up to 4 or 5 second lead over Tommy, following Tommy Bridewell. And then he sees the rain flags come out.
Yeah.
There were rain flags that come out around the track. So now he's the first rider to encounter any of this. So he knows what he's got in hand. So it didn't surprise me that he backed off. And then I think he's got, you know, a lap board to tell him, you know, he sort of like sees his 5 seconds goes down to, you know, 3 seconds or 2 seconds or whatever. And I think at that point he could just, you know, he was conscious of how, you know, done a few laps, he'd conscious how much rain was actually falling and how it was affecting the track. And I think he could just gap himself. He had the pace in hand to just keep, you know, a good cushion to Tommy Bridewell toward the end. Because I would have thought, too, if Tommy starts to see Scott coming back, Tommy, if he's got anything left, would have thrown it in and pushed absolutely. So I still think Scott had enough in hand there. Now, if it had started to really chuck it down, don't know.
Okay.
I mean, again, he's in a different position as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
he can
afford to, he just doesn't want to crash. So he can afford to even take a second, even a third, but he knows he needs the points. So
that's true.
You know, so I don't think he wants to throw it away as the first rider, you know, encountering these conditions. So I think he was maybe just being a bit canny. I think.
Yeah, maybe so. He is undoubtedly rider. He's undoubtedly the cleverest rider on the circuit.
Mm-hmm.
For me, 100%, his racecraft is beyond anybody else's.
But well, have you we'll got see TSL that maybe a little bit in race two?
Exactly. That's something we will come to without a doubt. I knew exactly what he was doing there.
Yeah.
But have you got TSL timing up for race one?
I do. Yeah.
Scott Redding's fastest lap.
129.639.
Set on.
Lap 18.
And nobody else was anywhere near him. Lap four, lap five, lap nine, lap four, lap six. And he and puts supposedly his fastest this lap is one of the rainy on lap 18.
Laps, is it not?
So it would be soon after it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, it would be soon after. I think the rain was sort of mid-distance-ish.
Yeah. So, likely you could hazard a guess that was him having backed off a little bit from the rain and maybe realised that Tommy was closing a little bit faster, he backed off a bit too much or whatever and just realised he needed
maybe
to get
so, yeah. No,
back
I'll take
on
that.
It again
yeah,
to put the pad back in.
Quite happy. And then he did, he put in a 129.639 on lap 18, which meant his tyre, he hadn't been trying that hard through the race if he still had that in the Pirellis.
Yeah, you're right. Much you look at everyone else's fastest lap, anyone else in the 129s were all early lap four.
Yeah,
lap five.
Four, five, and nine.
Yeah.
That's it. So, and lap nine was Hickey and Andy Irwin.
Yeah.
So, really, of the guys that you'd be expecting, Christian Iden was running third at the time, so his best lap was lap four. Josh Brooks on lap five and Bridewell's on lap four. So, to have that much left in his tyres on lap 18 is pretty commendable, don't you think?
Yeah, agreed. So we got into to race two, and I was hoping that we would get a little bit more of a race. I was hoping that extra dry running would allow a few people to go back and do a few tweaks. And I think... You know, you were talking about the podcast with Pete Hickman as well. I think he made some interesting points too. I mean, this is kind of more, I guess, probably at Assen, but I suppose, you know, some of this applies in coming to Donington as well, that some of these riders that are a little bit sort of out of contention can just come back and maybe try some pretty big setup changes to see, you know, just see if they can get something to work for race two.
Yeah, they have nothing to lose, do they?
No, I think, you know, definitely one of those riders, I think, was Danny Buchan. We saw, like, in qualifying, he wasn't that particularly strong, but in race two, he was a lot stronger.
He was, but the time gap's still big.
Yeah, it is from the Ducatis.
This is the problem. Whereas at Assen, he was, he managed to be on the coattails of the guys at the front. Here, he was, you know, he was 4 seconds behind Tommy Bridewell, who in turn was 4 seconds behind Josh Brooks. And I remember watching it at one point, and we were watching from the top of Hollywood at turn two. which has a big screen opposite it. So just as the guys are short shifting to go through Hollywood and then down the Craner curves, you had all four riders in sight. As you look across to your right, you had all four riders in sight at one point, and they were all equidistant apart. Scott Redding, Josh Brooks, Tommy Bridewell, and Danny Brooken were all equidistant apart of about, you know, sort of a second. And it's just like, really?
Well, I was just trying to think, I remembered like Scott making the break a little early on, and then it was kind of a bit more of a group with Josh, Tommy, and Danny. But it was only kind of the, like in the latter part where it just, Josh just seemed to really just bite the screen.
He did.
And go after Scott in, I mean, he was leaving nothing on the table. I'm not sure if I've seen Josh ride that number of laps at that.
But bear in mind what happened earlier in the race.
Yeah.
When Billy McConnell, he parted company with the yellow OMG Suzuki, and scattering gravel all across the exit of the Foggy S's.
Was it so him or Josh Owens?
No, it was Billy McConnell that threw that. Josh okay. Owens high-sided on the exit.
Ah, right.
Further okay. out. He got on the gap. He'd gone through the... on the exit of the of Foggy S's, there's quite a pronounced dip just on the apex. So in the qualifying, a lot of the guys were all cutting the curb.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a look on TSL, there were quite a lot of guys that got their lap time cancelled because they'd gone on the green paint. So to try and avoid that dip, a lot of the guys were taking to the curb to try and avoid it. Now, unfortunately, whether Josh Owens was unsighted, whichever, whatever happened, because it was obviously early in the race, the bump can unload the rear suspension. So obviously letting the rear wheel spin up, and I think that's what happened with Josh on the CDH machine.
Yeah, that's what it literally looked like. I remember, like you say, he was just that little bit wider, hit the bump.
Yeah.
And just lost the back, and that's...
It's exactly that, and that's and it was a big, heavy high side, and unfortunately, crash, the slow-mo camera's there as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it caught it in all its painful glory. But no, Billy was... He went through the gravel... beyond that and scattered gravel all over the circuit on like lap two or three, whichever it was, which brought the safety car out. Now, this is something that I haven't really seen before. From where we were watching, you could see Josh Brooks was leading at that time. He got the whole shot and he was leading the first couple of laps. Scott Redding backed everybody up by a good quarter of a lap. By the time they'd gone down Craner curves, Josh Brooks had exited McLean. So you can see right across to McLean's. And he was away round Coppice before the guys had come up almost at Old Hairpin and under Schwantz. But then you could hear the Ducati absolutely caned to catch up with Josh Brooks again to keep the heat in the Pirellis. Josh kept equidistant back from the safety car all the time, whereas for the two laps Scott Redding gave him 300-400 yards and then gassed it to get the heat in the tires. So when the safety car pulled in and the lights went, they were almost side by side as they crossed the start finish line. Obviously you can't pass, but you can be just shy of level. So Scott had the inside line on warmer tyres. Josh's bike chattered at the front, went wide. Scott went underneath him, and that was goodnight Vienna.
Yeah, it was.
Until later in the race.
I know. It was a pretty canny move. I've seen riders, normally the leading rider back up the pack. I've not necessarily seen someone second or third backing up the pack. But, I mean, it was pretty clear and logical why he was doing that. And potentially, I mean, the pack, as he went off, then also benefited from doing the same thing. I think the biggest loser there was Josh Brooks. But, I mean, this is all happening behind him. He's got no idea what's going on. And I mean, I thought it was pretty canny at the time, and he definitely got the result that Redding wanted. But am I right in thinking that I've seen some rule clarification published after this weekend?
Oh, I've not seen it. If there has been.
I have a feeling...
What, in terms of safety car?
Yeah, I think I've seen the BSB publish some rule clarification or just highlighting the fact that riders are not meant to, how can I put it, I don't know, vary their pace or slow up dramatically.
Oh, how interesting.
So, but it is one of these things to understand. It's like, oh, okay, well, how much is too slow and how much is for too long? How much is dramatically? How much is what?
And if you're actually doing it to keep heat in your tires, then it's a benefit. It's a safety.
Yep.
It's not a safety issue if you're going to get heat in your tires.
Yeah. I mean, there's a logic to what they're asking riders to do, but there's also, I think, a logic to how Scott interpreted the rules as to do what he could do. So
certainly.
So yeah, we'll see. I'll try and find that for you and send that on, because yeah, it'd be interesting to see what you think about that. But yeah, I mean, like I say, I mean the race for me sort of maybe came alive towards the end as just kind of past mid distance. I think I know Josh just really just for whatever reason, I don't know if the bike came to him. And he realized he could, you know, he had the confidence to push. But, I mean, oh, my God, he was really, really pushing on. I mean, not quite enough, I think, to close Scott down. I think Scott was probably watching his pit boards as well and just doing what he needed to do. But
he cut it close. There was a school of thought that he'd had a gear selector issue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he'd admitted in part firmly that he was having a problem with gear selection, because it was Josh's fastest lap versus Scott's fastest lap was only 0.2.
Yeah, but Josh was faster.
Oh, he was, no doubt, but he closed up by, I think, 0.75 seconds in one lap.
Yeah.
So there was definitely an issue with Scott and the bike, and he said it on... I believe he certainly said it on the circuit PA, but I believe he said it on the TV as well. So yeah, he wasn't playing, you know, it wasn't a bit of brinksmanship, thankfully. but four race wins on the bounce for Scott Redding really cements his chances of taking his first ever British Superbike title. A Ducati lockout, 1-2-3. Of Redding, Brooks and Bridewell. Danny Buchan, as you say, had a stronger ride to fourth place, but the gap, and then another gap back then to Christian Iden, who was having his own battle with Brad Ray and Andy Irwin, along with Chavi Forres, who were quite disappointing compared to their performances, certainly of Chavi Forres back in May, who was on the podium and I think scored a race win. Or did he get a couple of podiums? I forget. But he was certainly on the podium there for Honda Racing. Just a weekend to forget for McKenzie and O'Halloran. God knows what's going on there.
Yeah, I was surprised. I definitely thought
they were nowhere all weekend.
Either both of them, some of them would have been doing better than that.
Sure.
I mean, they finished together with pretty much equal best lap time. So I think that was showing that both riders were getting the best out of the package. But that's all that bike had to offer, unfortunately.
It seems it, doesn't it? A quick shout to Bradley Ray in sixth place, actually, from 19th on the grid.
That was impressive.
That was good, because he only got a couple of laps in race one, so he had to start from his best lap time. So that was good for him. Luke Stapleford, he faded for race two. Alex Olsen in 13th is a good result for him and the Smiths Racing BMW. Who else was there? Joe Francis just outside the points. James Ellison, 20th place. Okay.
Dean Harrison. For Peter Hickman, unfortunately, not to finish. I think his chain came off.
That's right. His chain came off at the bottom of the Melbourne loop. Yeah.
Yeah. So he just was effing and swearing, but was able to coast off the loop into
That's
the back.
Like Hickey.
But yeah, it was such a shame too after a fourth place in race one.
Very much so. And the model of consistency all season on a mechanical level, obviously crashing on somebody else's fluid at Alton Park, but overall, he's been the model of consistency. So the championship now going into the final round in just under 2 weeks' time, Scott Redding on 6.45 with Josh Brooks 28 points to the negative. So that's a full race win ahead of Josh Brooks plus three. Tommy Bridwell mathematically is still in it. He's 37 points back from Josh Brooks, 65, from Scott Redding with 75 points still to play for with the triple header at Brands. Buchan and McKenzie and Hickman, they're fighting for pride for where they finish. And Xavi Forres has taken over as the best of the rest for the Riders' Cup. He's on 186 points, with Andrew Irwin 5 points behind, Jason O'Halloran a further 14 points behind him. Christian Eden in 10th, a point further back there. They are the guys, really, the 20 points covering the four riders. 75 points still up for grabs. Anything can happen in British Superbikes. And we will be at Brands Hatch to see the season end.
Yeah, it's true to say that anything can happen. A lot of people, including myself, I remember, would be pretty thinking like, he's got this in the bag. But is it 2017 when Haslam was leading Shane Byrne?
Yep.
Into the final three races.
By nobody 32 would have predicted points. That.
Nobody would have predicted that.
No.
So, literally, yeah, anything can happen.
Anything can happen indeed. As we look through the other championships quickly, Jack Kennedy, back-to-back British Supersport champion, as we mentioned earlier, as he signed for Tag Yamaha, ahead of teammate Brad Jones, who we had on the show from Alton Park, with the injured Alistair Seeley in third place. You can tell that as we are talking, we just go through TSL timing. Sean Neary and the Ducati Performance Tri-Option Cup boys, that was won this weekend. It went down to the final race on Sunday afternoon, on Sunday lunchtime. It was Josh Day, after his first year in the championship, taking the title ahead of former champ Rob Guyver. Sean Neary in third place. You'll hear on the interview, you know, he's had, what has he had? 1, 2, 3, 4. He's had 5 race wins this year and numerous podiums. 5 race wins, 2 seconds, 3 thirds. But unfortunately, a couple of DNFs hit him hard ahead of Reggie Wainwright and David Shoebridge, who is an emerging Ducati Tri-Options Cup boy. He came strong towards the end of the season. Those guys aren't at Brands. They finish now until next year. The one championship that really does always catches my eye, is one that I really enjoy, is MotoStar Championship. It's going to change for 2020. It becomes the British Talent Cup. The GP machines are all done. The whole field will be on the customer NSF 250s. And there will be an age limit as well. So if you look at the top five will move on. There's no doubt about that. The American Brandon Pasch, he took a third and a first this weekend to extend his lead in the championship over Josh Whatley, who took a brace of second places. Late charge in the season from Asher Durham. He won the first race at Donington Park, but unfortunately DNF the second. Dan Jones, he had the struggle of a weekend on the city lifting machine. The young Welshman, who is an ex-Red Bull rookies campaigner, Morawaki Cup. All of these guys, they're all really good guys. I'm fortunate to know most of them on a personal level. Certainly the top five. One guy I met this weekend, which is the first time I've spoken to his dad a few times, but I met Scott Swan this weekend. He got third place in race 2 on Sunday. Lovely lad from Northern Ireland, big future ahead of him. When you look at the top five, really, Brandon Pasch, Asher Durham, Dan Jones and Scott Swan, for me, will all move up to a 600 of some description. Josh Whatley, he's only 14. He's going to go to Spain and contest the CEV Championship. But at the moment, looking at the title, Pasch leads it from young Josh Whatley. Pasch needs 2 more points than Whatley over the weekend to secure the title at his first attempt, really, at the championship. He was on the slightly underpowered Mahindra last year. He got some good results, but going on to the fireplace warehouse machine this year has really brought him to the fore. But the two guys that have battled all season long in the standard class, Motostar split into two, into the GP class and the standard. Scott Ogden and Cameron Horsman, they have been almost inseparable all season. They've shared wins, they've shared second places, but neither of them have finished third. I think Scott's had one finish at Knockhill that was, I think, sixth or seventh. But the rest of the races, they've either finished first, second, or DNF'd. So they've done well between them. Scott Ogden is the 2019 British Talent Cup champion. He is heading across to Spain for next season to contest the CEV Moto3 Championship. Cam Horsman, I think, will step up to a 600 of some description. What championships are we... Stock 1000. We mentioned that earlier. Did you manage to catch that one?
No, I didn't get to see the race. I'm actually going to go back and watch that just to see Chris Urás.
It was a good race because it was a kind of a race of attrition, really, because the issue with Taylor McKenzie and Lee Bob Jackson caused Lee Bob Jackson to sit up as Taylor went that high, you could almost see his house down the road in Ashby de la Zouche. But Cooper led the way, but Chrissy chased him down. And my old mucker Jordan Weave in third place, getting his maiden Stock 1000 podium. So it was nice because I've got a lot of time for Chrissy. We always stop and have a chat. Obviously, he was on the show from Alton Park as well. So his maiden Stock 1000 win, Jordan's maiden Stock 1000 podium. It was quite an emotional Parc Fermé watching the two boys in there. And that was something that stuck with me, seeing the emotion from Chrissy when he pulled in. And, you know, these guys all have day jobs, as we'll hear from Sean Neary and Keith Farmer in a few moments. But the emotion from Chrissy on his first Stock 1000 win, it just gave you a little bit of goosebumps. That human side to motorcycle racing, I love it. It's not just the racing on the track, it's the human emotion side of it as well that really, you know, it really floats my boat in that respect, because these guys work all week and then how hard they work off the track to be able to be their best on track, and the outpouring of emotion when they do succeed, it shows how much it means to them and why they end up paying it as much as they do for rides and trying to bring in sponsorship and not actually making any money from the sport, although hopefully Chrissy at least got a podium bonus and a win bonus for this weekend, the same with Jordan Weaving. But actually making a living from the sport, it's still a couple of seasons away from these boys yet.
Yeah, for sure. Like I say, it's difficult to not be around these teams without seeing, like, you know, the riders are just the tip of the iceberg. You see all the families and all the personal sponsors and all the people that are supporting and pulling with them. And, you know, each individual rider just carries this huge responsibility of the expectations of the team and all this family, you know, quite apart from their own personal expectations as well. So, you know, I think Chrissy always has kind of felt like it's one of these things where he needed a few things to come together for a weekend. He's definitely shown he's got the pace. He's definitely shown he's got the machinery. And I think, you know, when it finally all comes together, all those things line up and you get the result after that length of the time, I could just imagine the, you know, the relief and the emotion that flows through that. So, you know, I'm hoping too as well, that will sort of bounce into the three Brands Hatch and, you know, just carry that confidence, because you can't take that win away. You know, no one can take that win away from
you. No. Timesheets don't lie.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think, you know, it brings a confidence now. You know you can do it.
Yeah, and it is a monkey off his back. And he's being mentored by Alan Carter, the same guy that was looking after Ryan Vickers as well. And Alan's starting to spread his influence through the British Superbike paddock and trying to get Chrissy to smooth out, because he is an aggressive rider. He is all action. But he is, like most of the guys, all the guys in the British Superbike, they're all talented to a certain level. but only a few will make it to that next step. And I think Chrissy's got what it takes to make it to that next step, but it needs to be smoother and a little bit smarter. And he's certainly moving into that level now. He's a smart kid. There's no doubt about it. He's a math teacher who only works 3 days a week, but he's a math teacher anyway. So he is super talented and super smart. Whether sometimes he overthinks things or he just sometimes gets a bit raggedy. He's always been known as an aggressive rider, but he's smoothing out beautifully. And this is now going to see him reap the dividends of that without question.
Yeah, and the Superstock 1000 as well is a very competitive championship as well. Sure. So, you know, even just doing a clean race, keeping out of trouble, can be difficult.
It can, very much so. So, happy for him. Did we need to cover anything else? And sorry to send you to sleep during the MotoStar Championship.
But did we do Superstock 600?
And Superstock 600. Shane Richardson, he leads the way in Superstock 600 ahead of by 19 points. Ahead of Northern Irishman Corey McGreevy and Young Storm Stacey on the Stouth Connect Academy machine, which is
a great first name. Storm.
Storm Stacey. He's an absolute character, you know.
Oh, that's one of those great names. That's like Max Venturi.
Yeah. It's exactly nice. That. Yeah. He's such a quirky kid. he's had a lot of heartache over the last few years, has Storm. He lost his dad I think not long after he won his first British Championship race, when he was only 13 and a half, I think, at Silverstone. I remember him doing it. He lost his dad, Lester, not too long after. And then as he rode for... I can't remember the name of the team. Oh, that's gone. That's trying to do it off the top of my head. But then he was taken on by another team with a mentor, with Gary, and I can't remember Gary's last name, which is really sad. I know he's a Sheffield Wednesday fan. He was a big fan of Jordan's as well, was Gary. And he unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. So losing his mentor, losing his father first and then his mentor, he's had an awful lot to contend with at such a young age. And you'll see him going around the paddock. He had to buy a suit for, I can't remember what it was. Oh, it was for burnout. Thanks, Jennifer. It was for burnout last year that Stuart Garner and the guys from Norton put on at Donington Hall. They have their own little motorcycling festival on the first weekend of September. Storm bought a suit for that. And he now rides around the paddock with the suit on. He literally rarely, it looks like he's just come out of court. You know, he's like, Storm, we got a suit on. And he'll ride around and he's sat up and it's a three-piece suit and his white socks and his black shoes. And he's just an amazing, amazing talent. He's won numerous British championships in mini bikes and at that kind of level with Fab Racing. And now Brent Gladwin's taking him under his wing. He spends a lot of time in Sheffield with Brent and the team. And it's just a great little story of how he's had so much heartache over the last couple of 3 years, but he's still focused on his racing. And his smile never changes.
Well, and he must have been encouraged because it looks like he got some good results at the two races at Alton.
With the double win, yeah. And I think he came from towards the back of the grid with second place at Donington. Early start of the season, getting used to the 600. This mirrors a similar sort of thing that Jordan Weaving did in 2014. Storm came off almost a championship-winning run last season, the Fireplace Warehouse machine that Brandon Pash rides this year, the green and yellow KTM. Taking a step to a 600 machine is massive, from a 60 brake horsepower KTM to a 130 brake horsepower Kawasaki. You can see the way that his results go are the same, similar to Jordan Weaving. Jordan came of age at Cadwell Park and then finished on the podium at Alton Park. Whereas at Cadwell, Storm finished sixth and then did the double at Alton Park. So he's finished on the podium in the last three races. Certainly championship potential. And if he stays in the same class next year or goes to Supersport, he will be a force to be reckoned with, no question.
Yeah, this also reminds me too, you know, it's like as you start to get closer to the paddocks, you start to get to know all the different riders and their stories and the families and, you know, the personnel and stuff. It gets really, really hard to sit back and be the fan and cheer for individual riders because you want to cheer for all of them because you know what it takes. You know what they've sacrificed. You know how hard they've worked. You know, whether they're sort of in the middle or at the back of the grid. When people talk to me about kind of favorite riders and stuff like this, it becomes really, really hard because you think about, like, say, all these individuals and their individual stories and stuff like that, and you just want all of them to do well, you know?
You do. And his name's come to me, and God bless him, it was Gary Dawson.
Cool.
Who passed away, bless him. He really took Storm under his wing and developed him into an even better Moto3 rider. It was Gary Dawson, God bless him.
Well, this is perfect. This is why I like taking a minute just to run through some of the support classes, because these are, you know, the names of riders potentially that we'll see moving up and, you know, potentially, you know, BSB riders, or as we've seen, some of them now going off to a CEV. You know, we might start to see them up through CEV into Moto2, into Moto3, in the GP paddock as well. So, you know, this is the purpose of a lot of these younger classes as well, is to start, you know, helping breed the next riders. We don't necessarily have some of the advantages that some of the Spanish riders and Italian riders have with, you know, the frequency, the circuits and the availability and, you know, stuff we're having to battle in the UK, things like noise limits and other things as well. So it's great to see that there are, you know, ways for these riders to move out into CEV. And yeah, that's why I think it's cool to talk about some of these riders. So hopefully we'll start to see them coming up through some of the more high profile classes, you know, in the next year or two.
Which is why I enjoy MotoStar so much. You know, your Luke Hedges of this world, your Jordan Weavins, Tom Booth, Amos, Jake Archer, guys like that, ex-champions, Joe Francis, prime example, into British Superbikes now. It's worth keeping an eye on these smaller classes to see where these guys end up. And, you know, they genuinely are a great bunch of kids. And this is why I end up knackered after a weekend, because you're walking through the paddock and you're chatting to all these guys and their families. You get to know them. They become friends. And watching the racing becomes that little bit more personal. And you want so many of them to do well that you can't have a favorite rider.
Yeah.
It's not GPs, you know, where you can pick, oh, you know, you're a Rossi fan, you're a Marquez fan, or like me, you're a Jorge Lorenzo fan. I am the only one still. But yeah, that personal touch, and this is why I love it so much. We've been around there a long time, and we're fortunate to know some great people. And to watch their careers progress is just fabulous.
Yeah, I think, you know, you just end up loving the sport.
It's that. More than I've always been a fan of the sport, without a doubt. And that's what happens when you look through some of these forums like Crash and Bike Sport News on FaceTube. You just think, what are you guys on? It's about the sport, not the rider particularly. It's the sport as a whole. But speaking of the sport as a whole, the sport of motorcycle racing as a whole, would we be able to put the link to the Just Giving page for Oliver Brindley on the show notes, please?
Yep, I can do that.
Thank you. Ollie was on the show a few years ago with me after his first foray into the Super Prestigio, racing against likes of Mark Marquez and guys like that. Unfortunately, the weekend before last, he had a massive crash in New Jersey, in the flat track in New Jersey. A couple of guys had gone down in front of him, and unfortunately he hit one of the bikes at pretty much full knock. I've seen a still of the crash, and he, without fear of exaggeration, Ollie's 9 feet in the air, and he's currently in hospital in New Jersey, in a critical condition. His dad, Derek, is a former world sidecar contender. His uncle, Barry Brindley, was a sidecar man. His cousins do the the Mablethorpe Beach races. And Ollie's highly thought of in the British dirt track community, with the Neve boys and Pete Boast, who works out at Market Raisin. But Ollie's been plying his trade in America for the past two seasons, trying to break through into that that lucrative dirt track community. And he's done a fantastic job at it. But unfortunately, at the moment, him and his family need all the help he can get, with costs and, you know, what it's like in America with the health and the insurance side of things over there. Just if anybody can just add, you know, just a couple of quid into Ollie's fund, I'd be hugely grateful for that. And so would the Brindley family.
Yeah, no doubt. I know some other people have used the Just Giving cause, and I think it's less about the amount of money, but just recognizing that people take some time to help and support. I imagine sure. just gives a huge emotional boost.
Yeah, absolutely. To the family, it's set up by his godfather, so all the money is going to Ollie. It's not set up by a fan. It's set up by his godfather.
Perfect. Thanks for mentioning that, Dave. That's great.
And thank you for putting it in the show notes. I appreciate that.
Yeah, will do. So let's finish off leading into the two interviews that you were able to grab at Donington, which was with Keith Farmer, as we mentioned, and Sean Neary as well.
Indeed.
That will follow us as we wrap up. And I say thank you very much.
Always a pleasure. Today. Thank you.
Very best of luck for the rest of this week.
Wonderful. Thank you, mate.
Stay out of trouble. Yes, sir. No, sir. Right way, sir.
It's kind of that, yeah.
And all the rest of it. No, seriously. I think it's one of these things that, like I say, I know after so long transitioning into a new role is going to be good, but hopefully, you know, it's kind of exciting and interesting and kind of exhilarating as well. And the fact that you're sort of located in a slightly different part of the world,
indeed,
in the UK as well.
It's all new.
A little wave. I'm sure she's sitting on the couch there waiting for you to shut up.
She's already watched a Great British Bake Off on subtitles. She does great. She enjoys watching Motopod from this end. And then we've only got one more to do. And then that's the season done for us, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. Well, for the rest of you, I say as we wrap up, if you want to, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/motopod as well, which is the Motopod fan page. Have a look, like, subscribe, and leave any comments there. We're also on Twitter as well at @moto_pod. And you can also follow Dave Neal on Twitter and Instagram at
Dave Neal on Twitter and the Dave Neal on Instagram.
Fantastic. Dave, thanks very much indeed for giving us some of your time. And thanks to Jen as well for letting you out to play. Have a good rest of the week.
Jen and Andy says thank you.
And look forward to catching up after the final round at Brands.
No doubt we'll be in touch. You take care, mate. And thanks very much.
Cheers. On to the interviews.
We're still in the paddock at Donington Park. We're sat in the Tyco BMW truck, and I'm delighted to say that joining me for the first time in what seems like years I can't remember when it was that we last spoke. It must have been 2013, 2014 for the podcast.
Yeah.
After...
I remember where it was too. I was
seriously?
I was working down in Manchester at the River Airwell on an emergency job, and I remember... standing chatting to you and know exactly what, I don't know why it just came back into my head there now, but yeah, that was start of 2014.
It was start of 2014. I'm amazed. Thanks, mate. Keith Farmer, Tyco BMW, welcome back to Motopod. We know you're out at the minute. We've had a look at the leg, and oh my god, it's healing well. But mate, you've been through the mill a bit since Knock Hill, haven't you?
Yeah, it's been a rough few weeks to start with. You know, like crash Saturday, Sunday operated on, second operation on the Tuesday, stood up Tuesday evening,
which is ridiculous.
It's amazing what they can do nowadays. You know, like two rods in each, or a rod in each leg. And then, you know, it took me 10 minutes to get into my head that I could stand up, because when the doctor said stand up, I was just like, mate, I've just broke my legs. And he's like, I've just fixed them, stand up. I'm like, all right. You know, and to get into my head that I wasn't going to crumble when I stood up and break my legs even more was unbelievable. But after I did, then it was just day by day. And then a week and a half I was in the hospital, got out, and it was the best thing ever of getting out, because, you know, as good as the hospitals are, when you have four people in a ward and they're pressing buzzers, you know, looking pain relief, and, you know, people snoring as they do, and I just couldn't sleep. I wasn't getting no rest, and you need your rest for your recovery. So as soon as I got out, it was absolutely mega. I had my own bed that I could sleep in, and you know, little one around me every day, and it's just been getting slowly better and better every day, you know. And I think when you have a little bit of motivation to actually want to get better, then you apply that to yourself, and you know, you give it everything. I've had, you know, for 3 weeks on the trot after I got out, I travelled from Penrith to Blackburn every single day for cryotherapy. You know, anything to help. I have had laser treatment, loads of physio now, and ever since 3 weeks ago, I think, when my legs started to heal up, then I could jump in the swimming pool, and I've been doing that every morning, and just getting better, you know, just building it up slowly, and I've been back cycling and everything, so it's just slowly, but we're getting there.
Up to that point, you'd had a pretty, by British Superbike standards, learning, coming off the success of the Superstock Championship the year before, your fourth British Superstock and Supersport title, which is an incredible record.
Yeah.
You know, let's be fair, when we spoke, that was after the first, 2014 was Superbikes.
Yeah, 2013 and 14 was...
Birdie.
Birdie, then PR.
And NPR.
Yeah.
That was the one.
And then 15, I wasn't in the paddock at all. So to come back in 16, you know, to be fair, that was probably one of my most fun years, because I rid the Fireblade. And, you know, I just had fun all year, and it just showed that to ride the Fireblade, the underpowered bike that year, was just so... It was an achievement for me, because we were going in there thinking, oh, we're like 15, 20 brake horsepower down, and everyone will struggle to get in the top 5, top 10. And then to come out at the end of the year, you know, with two race wins and the third in the championship, was just mega. So, you know, and fair play to Ian Woollacott, who'd give me that year. It set me up for the next year, you know. Well, I thought it had, but then, you know, I had nothing on the table again, you know, and...
which I could never understand. And they've not been back in the championship since. No. You were the last rider for Key Garage Honda.
Yeah.
So you were the last rider for them. But then, having nothing on the table...
And then going to a fill-in rider because
2017,
of...
2017.
Yeah.
Luke Jones got injured for Appleyard McAdam.
Yeah, and testing.
In testing. So then you stepped in your black leathers here, first round?
Yes, I believe so, yeah. Yeah, it was.
Went on...
To finish the season.
Was literally in... With the team, in the shout for the championship. Stayed with the same team for the following season.
That was, 17, I won the championship.
They won the championship 17, that same season.
Yeah. So, as a fill-in rider,
of course, then 18 for Tyco BMW on the Stocker, and then we're in 19.
Yeah.
I'm losing my years already.
So
not that we've been keeping track of you, of
I
course.
Think possibly one of the first riders to fill in, maybe, and win, you know, a title. And I didn't expect to do the full year, you know, and then to go on to do the full year and actually win the championship was just, whoa.
But while you're here, that 2017 season, you took the Super Sports Championship by storm. From Alton Park until Brands Hatch, what the fuck happened? Because you could have won it at Alton Park, and unfortunately things didn't go right. Yeah. What happened at the end of that season?
My head sort of fell off my shoulders. I just had the crash at Alton in the wet when I was leading. And here, easy mistake. But then I went to Aston, and I fell off again in the first race on the Saturday because it was raining. And then race two, What happened? I ended up hitting a false neutral, and then I ended up ramming Ben Curry off the track.
Yes.
And then they give me a stupid second penalty.
Yeah.
Which obviously they wanted to bring it back to Brandon's Hatch, the final round. The first race at Brandon's Hatch, I absolutely obliterated myself and ended up in the tire wall at turn three, which was not a good crash. It was a heavy crash. And then I had to finish in sixth. No, the top eight, I think it was. So I literally went out to finish in the top eight.
Second, third and fourth gear all the way round. Pretty bring much it home.
So. Yeah. And honestly, I got to that point, like even on Saturday, at the end, you know, on the Saturday at Brown's Hatch, I actually thought, this is not meant to be. You know when you get in something in your head, and not well, I'm a negative thinker, but I just...
Far from it.
I was just like, I've lost nearly 100 points now. What is going on?
Yeah.
Like you say, I could have won at Oldham Park, and if I had just been sensible with it. But it's one of them, you live and learn, and, you know, we've went on and been sensible with it since, a little bit.
Ish.
But, yeah, and then obviously 18 brought another title, so I've... My four titles, have not all of them, but two each have been back-to-back. So, and then this year was obviously, it just wasn't to go to plan. But, you know, from what I think I've done in so little time on the BMW, like,
I think they were late, weren't they? So you didn't get the bikes until pretty much the first round.
Yeah. Yeah.
So trying to build from that, I know Smiths were in a similar position and everything else. Yeah. It was a BMW thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything to do with the team particularly. But as a racer, you're coming off the back of a championship. You're peaking, you're at the top of your game from that sense. Yeah. And you're coming into the British Superbike Championship again, which you'd almost had a bit of a love-hate relationship with Birdie and things that happened there. And then PR, which wasn't quite the strongest bike on the grid that you had to override to get what you wanted to do. But you sit here as a four-time British champion and you're going into your second bite of the cherry at the British Superbike Championship. How did you approach the season with the BM and the new Superbike?
Just obviously I'd never really rid the old BM in Superbike format, you know, and I rid it one day in testing, and I actually got off it and shook Christian's hand, and I says, I do not know how you've went so fast on that. I says, because they weren't good. And you know, but then, you know, getting the new bike, the first time I rode it in completely super stock trim, it wasn't even super stock trim, it was literally the road, like, set of fairings on it.
Road trim with a bit of plastic and some tyres.
And literally got off it, and I smiled, and I just literally said to Philip, I says, that bike is an awesome piece of kit. I says, we should have some fun. And when you have that feeling straight away, then it just, you know, it leaves you a bit more excited for it, and it was going into the season, you know, I needed to be sensible and not try and absolutely put it upside down every weekend. And, you know, if we were to take a top 10 or take, you know, a top 15, that's what we'd take. And the season that started out, I was finished most races and ended up in the top 10. Yeah. So I was pleasantly surprised because the depth of field that's been in, and especially the bike has, like, I ran a stock swinging arm, and everything was relatively stock. And, you know, to have, like, I ended up finishing sixth, was my best position. Yeah. And to have that was, you know, on the back of the three Ducatis, exactly. You know, the McKenzie, O'Halloran, Buchan, you know.
It's no mean feat.
And to be fair, with how stock the bike was, I was happy with that. And, you know, every time, like, even when it came to Donington here last time, you know, I put it on the top of the pile for FP2. And then, you know, I just probably put a little bit of pressure on myself then to go out the next session and do the same again. So we ended up having a crash. And then I just knocked my confidence that little bit to push. So, but yeah, it's just one of them. Knock Hill was, unfortunately, that I touched the white line. Down we went, and 9 times out of 10 when you have a big crash, it's like, well, the bike doesn't usually collect you, but
no, the bike goes one way, you go the other, invariably.
But unfortunately this time it did, but I'm a positive thinker, and if it had a lit on my upper half, like I said, everyone that I've spoke to that mightn't have been here today, you know. So we're here, we're trying to get a job for next year, and you know, we'll see what happens.
What we're looking at for next year, what's the plan going forward now? We know you're not back this season.
Yeah.
Because of the extent of the injuries, but the main thing is, it's bloody great to see you sat here anyway and cycling around the paddock. We saw you at Cadwell with MLAV.
Yeah.
It's just great to see you back, keeping that face of yours in the paddock, talking to people and doing. From now here at Donington, with one round to go at Brands in a couple of weeks, and then the winter break, what's the plan for Keith Farmer now? What we're looking
at
for next year?
Like, just building up. Obviously, try and get another superbike ride is me and aim, with particularly some wages, which is always nice. You know, been doing it now since 2011 with none, and working a full-time job. And you know, it's great that my boss from work is actually very into racing, and he comes to every round, so it's nice to have that support. But at the same time, it's just, you know, you need to put full effort in, and to do the job right, I would just like my bills covered, and then I can put more effort in. You know, not that I don't put full effort in, but when you're...
No, but mentally it's different.
Yes, and that's where we're at, you know, try and do a real good job, just build back up strength-wise in my legs, you know, swimming, cycling, and just slowly get back to full fitness. You know, on the 16th of this month, I'm actually going to Wigan for a Supermoto day, so I've been invited along, and it's one of them.
You're not riding, are you?
Please if it's dry, I've said I will. But if it's wet, I'm not going to, just for the risk. But I just, my bones are healed now. The doctor said on my 12-week X-ray that my bones in my right leg are completely healed.
So they're knitted and done. Do you have to have the rods taken out, or are they going to stay?
I will do in time. Yeah.
Okay.
My left leg, the main tibia, is healed. The fibula, not that it's not important, but it's not of a great importance. But it was the only one in my last X-ray that wasn't just right.
But for doing this job, it is kind of important. We've seen Christian ride with a broken tibia, and you're not. Literally, you're not on the races.
No,
you can ride, but you can't race.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And that's, you know, in a sense, I could have done the last two rounds here for Tycho, but you know, sometimes it probably would do you like more harm than good, because you're going out to ride round to be safe, not going out to actually race. And I just do want to come back and end up being known, well, he finished 16th or 7th, you know
nobody
what I mean?
Sees the backstory to it, they just look at the timesheets and that's what they get. Plus if you get collected in somebody else, if you were where you shouldn't be and you get collected when Joe, like Josh Owens had his crash coming out of Foggies, you get caught up in that. Keith, you're not fit to crash.
No.
You're fit to ride, you're not fit to race, you're not fit to crash.
No.
Exactly. And you're certainly not fit to ride a fucking supermoto.
Yeah.
I know, but you can, because you're a multiple champion in supermoto, but you know what you're doing there's no doubt. But seriously.
Yeah, it's mainly just to see how I am feeling on a bike.
Okay.
And is my head in the right place to ride a bike again comfortably?
Yeah.
And then hopefully, if we can get signed up for next year, hopefully get testing somewhere nice and warm in either December or November.
Yeah.
And then the official test will start in February, March time next year. So and just like say, do be sensible over the winter, build it up, and just get ready for next year. And like I say, with the rods, I have to go see my doctor on the 30th of October, so it'll be another X-ray job, and just him to assess the job and see how far the rods are ready to come out.
Yeah.
You know, because if my bones are still a little bit weak, well, obviously there's too much risk, but obviously the sooner they come out, the more time I have to heal for next year.
Of course. Yeah, it makes sense that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, success last year, you've had good success this year on the Superbike, running from stock. The team have done their best to build the bike they can with the parts that are available.
Yeah.
It's been well documented that the bike isn't in full Superbike spec yet by any stretch. Yeah. How have you found this year's been? You enjoyed riding it?
Yeah.
It's been the bike for you?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it, to be fair. You know, the last time I was on a Superbike was obviously 2014 on Quack, you know, so and it was really hard work then, you know, and with the new BM, of how good a package it is, it's a fun bike to ride, you know, and when you're enjoying yourself, it leaves it that little bit easier, you know. And don't get me wrong, because it's down 5 miles an hour, yeah, you know, on the Ducatis and the other bikes. It leaves it, yeah, do have to ride it a little bit harder in turns and that, but, you know, that's basically the only thing that I see that it would need for next year is another 5 miles an hour, and it'll be really competitive. So, you know, we'll see. Watch this space.
As far as next season, spoken to teams already? Are you putting plans in place?
Yeah.
Just to see what's going on? I'm not asking who, because that's none of my business, but there are meetings going on and thinking about things looking
The likelihood, to be honest, is I have a yes or no to give to someone today.
Okay.
There is things that I'd like and wait for and this and the other, but I can't take the chance, you know, to be ended up left and dropped. And because obviously with teams, if I'm their number one choice, well, they'll be ringing me.
Yeah.
But with no calls coming through, you know, I have to take the decision that they're obviously trying other areas. So, and I have to do right for myself and family, and, you know, my bills need covered. So, you know, and I just, if I feel more comfortable going somewhere, well, that's where I'll go.
How difficult is it to balance as a superbike, as a stock rider, to a superbike rider? Are there different demands on you as a rider within the team? I spoke to Sean Neary earlier on in the Ducati Cup.
Yeah.
And he's a recruitment guy. He has his own recruitment company. So he works Monday to Friday. You work Monday to Friday or on a Wednesday, whichever. How do you balance that with Sam and Chloe and heading back to Northern Ireland with Sophie? How do you balance what's going on?
Honestly, I think that's what it's made me realise of how much time, you know, I don't have whenever since I've been broke my legs. Like, you know, in racing, when you're in it, you're in it, you know, and you just genuinely don't have time to do this or that and the other, and whole holidays have been non-existent recently. And, you know, throughout this summer, I done actually out of calendar at the start of the year, and I had one free weekend a month, you know, to spend with my own family and such, and the rest was either racing or doing something. Well, it was racing usually 2 weekends a month, and then one weekend was flying back to Sofa for Friday morning to Sunday evening, and then the other weekend is free, you know, and then obviously you have to take into that of work throughout the week. So I didn't really see much of them during the week other than 6 o'clock, get home from work or whatever, and then, you know, you have your dinner, a quick hour, spend time with Chloe, you know, playing and this and the other, and then bed.
And she's off to bed, bless her.
And, you know, then you don't see her in the morning because you're away out of the house at 5:30 to do your training. You know, and I don't think, like, even my dad said to me, you can't keep carrying on like that because you're running yourself into the ground.
Absolutely.
And I never realised it until I stopped and my body just went, switched off, you know.
Thanks, at last.
And you just wear and tear, you know, you run yourself into the ground.
Yeah.
And it's took its toll, but now I've realised what I've been doing and, you know, I'm trying to come out the other side of it.
Well, we wish you all the very best, especially over the winter with the healing process. It's looking nasty, but it's looking good at the same time.
Yeah.
We know how bad it was. We wish you all the best for the winter in the search for your next adventure. We want to see you back here next year, mate. And if you can get back here with a bit of wage behind you as well, then all the better. 4 British Championship titles, I think you've earned it.
I would like to think so. Cheers.
Cheers, Keith. Thanks, mate.
Spot on.
When you get to the end of a race, usually at the end of the weekend, the riders will help the team pack down. I'm down at SMC Racing, the Ducati Tri-Options Cup. I'm here with race winner throughout the season. Where did he finish in the championship in the end?
Third overall.
Third place. I thought so. I didn't want to say that and then get kicked because he sat opposite me. Sean Neary, welcome to Motorpod, mate. So chuffed to have you on. We've been friends through the paddock for quite a while now.
Cheers, mate.
I'm really chuffed to get you on the podcast at last.
Cheers, mate. Thanks very much.
Third place in the championship. Difficult race today.
Yeah.
Sketchy conditions at Donington Park. It's been pretty shit all weekend. And we'll start off on the lower note. Coming into the weekend, you did have a tilt at the championship.
Yeah.
The point, it was two races, race yesterday, race today.
Yeah.
The championship was there, which... Over the years that you've done
the Ducati Tri Options Cup. Your consistency has been that you've been a regular podium man, regular race winner, but this is the one where just that championship was in touch at the last round.
Yeah, I mean, in 2016 I was 5 points off winning it, and that's where the nearly nickname came in, which was pretty annoying, to be honest. But yeah, you know, it's been close this year, and you know, me, Rob and Josh, we've pushed each other all the way. There's been some epic scraps all the way through, and whoever kind of came out on top, I think, deserved it at the end of the day. And
without a doubt.
Yeah, the other lads will say that. And, you know, yeah, it's disappointing you come to the end of the year, and especially for me, I've been in it a few years now, and it's one of those things that, you know, I have always wanted to win it, there's no secret, but sometimes you have to take a step back and think, well, when I joined it, you know, it was like, right, I want to try and get in the top 10, and we've always improved, really, to the point where we are consistently at the front, you know, winning races. And it's not easy at the end of the day. You know, it's a really competitive class. The lads at the front are, you know, everyone's riding the wheels off it. So yeah, you know, sometimes you have to take a step back and say, yeah, it's not bad at all. And, you know, the team have been absolutely brilliant. You know, my bike this year has been good enough to win, there's no doubt about it. I just went a bit banzai sometimes and messed it up, really, but story of my life.
But that's what we were talking about before we came on air, was the fact that whereas before you'd gone the consistent route, but there had to be a change this year to really go for the wins, to go for the big points, and see what comes from that.
Well, yeah, in the past I have been probably a bit inconsistent, is one way of saying
not
it, really.
Consistently inconsistent, surely not.
and last year, when I started the year, I had a strategy of right, you know, I'll just take safe podiums. What was it? Be fast when you can, smart when you can't. That old saying. And it was kind of working. And then I was leading the championship, went into Snetterton, the midway point of the year, and we'd literally just refreshed the engine, so everything should have been good. And just bad luck, the engine blew up, so that messed up my whole weekend. And then you know, I think I was like 30 points behind then. And in fairness to Rob, last year he was kind of faultless then, but
he was so strong last year. Yeah, there wasn't a lot you could do.
I tried that strategy of, you know, being consistent early on, and then you have the mechanical. So this year I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna go for it. We changed to KTech suspension, that worked really well for us. So I was mega happy with the bike all year, and I just gave it a good go. And the second half of the year, I think we've scored something. We worked out the other day, we scored like 50 more points than the other two. But the first half of the year wasn't very good, really, because we just switched suspension and we were struggling a bit, really. And that's kind of what's cost us. But that's racing at the end of the day. So.
Difficult to find your way as well sometimes, especially over the weekend. You don't get the amount of track time that the guys in the British Championships get in your Motostar and your Supersport and your Superbikes. They get an FP3. Yeah. You don't get a huge amount. And, of course, you work for a living as well. You have a Monday to Friday job as well. Just remind me what you do.
Well, I started my own recruitment business about 3 years ago. My business partner is actually my teammate, Craig, although he's got a different business. It is pretty tricky, because if you do a test day or a track day, I mean, it's the same for most people. You know, if they have a day off work, you're kind of losing money. So there is that element. But then you need, because like you say, you do get really little track time. You need to try and get track days in when you can. But it is really obviously difficult because you've got a mortgage to pay. And
exactly that.
You know, soon family to support and stuff like that. So it's a fine line. But the thing is, with our class, you get the 4 tyre stickers. So the lads at the front, we're really limited on qualifying as well. So we can only really do 2 or 3 laps in qualifying, because we're trying to save the tyre.
Yeah.
So the little track time that you get, you still can't really maximise that at the race weekend. So
you're always on a compromise almost.
Yeah, but
it, just it's just same for everybody.
Yeah,
it is a compromise class in that respect.
Yeah, it's the same for everyone, but. But it's great to be part of the British Superbike paddock at the end of the day, because, you know, we have really good support from you know, sponsors, product sponsors, you know, like your Shark Helmets, Danish Leathers, D-Store Manchester. They help us out, and it is the kind of platform to promote your sponsors, really, because, you know, no disrespect to club racing, it's obviously a brilliant way to get going, but there's no exposure there for the sponsors, really.
It doesn't have the reach, does it?
Yeah,
the social media reach, which is important these days.
Yeah, so although we're kind of the back of the programme a lot of the time in the BSB, it is good to be part of the paddock, and it does bring you on, because you are riding against, even in any class, you know, at the front, you've got really strong riders, so it brings you on as a rider.
So Josh Day is an ex-Stock 1000 race winner, I think.
He won,
or he's a front runner.
No, he won.
Was he Stock 6?
He was telling me yesterday, actually. He won Stock 600.
Stock 6, that's it.
when I think it was the year there's like Buck and Stapleford and all that. Yeah. So he's no Morgan then. I've battled with Rob for a few years now, and you know, Rob's a class act, you know.
Rob Guyver was British 125 champion.
I think so, yeah, and then he's,
if I remember rightly,
Triple Challenge and Supersport Cup, was it?
He's so, like almost a one mate king.
Yeah, and when he gets going he's an absolute machine, and he's, you know,
he's an angry little fella.
Yeah. But he's, you know what, he's a really decent bloke, and you know, I have a lot of respect for him because you know, he's just dead down to earth. If he gets beaten, he says fair play, and vice versa. And we've had some great scraps, and you know, he if they had the budget, he would be, you know, a front runner in, you know, Stock 1000. There's no doubt about it. So he's a great, you know, person to race against and push yourself, really.
Same for yourself, for Josh Day. I know Luke Jones has been in the championship as well. Reggie Wainwright's been in as well. You're all fast lads.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that it's the budget that you can accrue at the minute would keep you at this level? And it's not the fact that you don't want to race or you can't. It's the budget is a massive thing in motorcycle racing these days. How do you go about bringing the budget together, and how do you go racing and balance your day job at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, when I started out, I was a bit stupid, really, I suppose, 8 years ago, and it was, you know, I had, you know, there's people in the local village who put in like 20 quid, 50 quid just to get us to each race weekend, and then I racked up credit cards and stuff, and a bit of a stupid way of doing it, I suppose, but it is, they say racing's like a drug, and it is, really. And then, you know, I always tried to present ourselves properly with the sponsors, and in 2014 I got a big sponsor then, so each year we've kind of added to it, and I try and look after my sponsors because I do truly appreciate it. I know that,
of course,
you know, it's not my mum and dad paying for it, so I know what it takes to kind of get that money in, so I do really appreciate it. And I think, well, hopefully they can see that, and each year we've kind of added to that, to the point where now I'm really fortunate that you know, most of the costs are covered. But I think if you ask any of the lads at the front of the Ducati Cup, we love being in it, but to make that next step to Stock 1000, you're talking probably minimum £20,000, because you've got more rounds, there's more tyres, you know, you're up against some really professional teams, you know, like your Honda and Bathams and all that, Tyco, and they've got, you know, full time staff, so there's no point in just rocking up with half the budget and wheeling a bike out of the van, because, you know, not being defeatist, but you're not going to...
Well, you can, but you'll run top 20, not top 10.
Yeah, you're not going to stand the chance, so yeah, I think everybody would love to make that step, but we're quite realistic, and you kind of look at your budget and say, well, where are we going to get the most from that budget, and to kind of run at the front. So
running round at the front of this championship is always going to be infinitely better than running round in the top 20 with no TV coverage, anything else. But you guys have had some great scraps this year. It does make for entertaining racing with the guys at the front. Yes, the field can be quite spread out, but for the front and for the championship, like I said, those boys are no mug. It must be good fun racing against them all.
Yeah, it's mega, and you know, we're all on the same bike at the end of the day, so, you know, we're absolutely riding the wheels off it. And it's quite funny, really, because when I was, a few years ago, when I was trying to break into like the top six, and then it was like top five, and work my way forward, and I thought, you know, at the front everyone would just be really smooth, and don't get me wrong, they are smooth, but they're riding the wheels off it, you know, like I was chasing Rob yesterday in that race, and you know, he's leaving black lines, it's spinning up, and everybody's pushing hard. It's not, you know,
would it be right to say that the riders at the front, yourself and the guys that we mentioned, you are, and I mean this with the greatest respect to the Ducati, are you guys beyond the level of the bike at this time of the season?
Would that
be fair to say?
Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, they are road bikes, and you know, if you see I think the times from the race yesterday, we would have been top 20 in the Stock 1000, and we're like 50 brake horse down, so it shows how hard we're riding them. But then, you know, you get good riders on it like Luke, or you know, they're going to be at the front, and it's the good riders, and it all comes down to consistency at the end of the day. You know, they can just consistently bang out the times, Josh, you know, Rob, and that's why we're kind of at the front. So
it's why you've got that little gaggle of riders at the front, then there's a bit of a gap because you're all of a similar level.
Yeah, like when I started breaking through in the championship, I'd be able to maybe do one good lap time, but then I might be a second off on the other laps, and then by the end of the race, you're 6 seconds back or whatever, and it's all about that consistency which you need to find. But I suppose you get that with experience, and
it comes
confidence.
With that, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you'd be 25 soon, so you know that consistency.
I wish, mate. Bloody 35 soon.
I didn't see the lap times from earlier. You didn't go faster than a 2:06, did you?
In
your race.
In the wet race?
No, in your dry race. Did you go faster than a 206?
Bloody hell, mate. Come on. Give us a bit of credit.
No, really. Did you go faster than a 206?
33s we were doing yesterday.
Fuck's sake. Well, that was my best time from Wednesday at the Ron Aslam Race School. So I was setting the benchmark for everybody.
Oh, mate, you'd be on for a podium, mate.
So seriously, you're all just, like, showing off. There's me ragging it around here as best I can on 50% throttle, and you lot make it look easy.
Mate, you've just got to keep grafting.
Jesus. What are the plans for next year? What we're looking at? What's the plan now? Now we have a new. Oh.
Phone going. Sorry, mate.
What's the punishment for that? I'm sure it's a bottle or something, but I can't remember what it is. It's too cold. I won't reach. If we look at for next season, looking into 2020 now, what are the plans for Sean Neary? Newlywed, family on the way, which from all of us at Motorpod, congratulations on
Cheers,
both
mate.
Of those. So chuffed for you. What do we see next from Sean Neary? What are we looking at for 2020?
I want to carry on racing. I don't know if that is going to be my last race. I hope it's not, but at the end of the day, it does come down to budget. So I feel like I've been in the Ducatis for years now, so I'm not saying it's easy or anything, but I'm ready for that next challenge, and it's always been a dream of mine to go to Stock 1000, but I just want to go with a proper package and the people around so that we can have a go at trying to get some good results, really. So I'll be working hard the next few weeks, getting my portfolio together, speaking to potential sponsors and all my current sponsors to see what we can get together, and if we can raise the budget, then yeah, hopefully I'll be in Stock 1000, which would be an absolute dream. I've got our first challenge due at the end of March, so just ready for the start. I think it's actually 10 days before the first round, so if I do make it on the grid next year, I might look a bit jaded in the first one.
Your timing was dreadful. Aren't they supposed to be born in, like, November and December as a racing
yeah,
child?
Yeah, I messed it up completely. And it's actually due on the 28th, so it's bound to be April Fool's if it's a...
Never! Yeah, not a chance!
Yeah,
so Philip Schofield's birthday, weirdly.
He's
a good guy.
Yeah, he's fast,
like you. He's a good bloke.
He's fast. That'll be all right. But yeah, obviously I can't wait for that. And we'll just try and get everything together over the winter and come back. I mean, I love being in the paddock. It's like a family. And I would be sad to leave it. But on the other side of it, I've had a great few years at it. I've been really fortunate to be part of it. So. I'm not going to be bitter.
I don't want to make this interview your last one, because this was the last round of the Ducati Tri-Options Cup for 2019. So I'm hoping that now we managed to catch up, that this isn't the last time we speak to you.
Hopefully
But you wouldn't be anyway, because you're welcome on the show anytime, mate. Not a problem
Legend.
At all.
Cheers, pal.
We wish you all the best.
Thank you.
For Nicola and for baby coming on, everything for through the winter. Get those sponsors together. See you back in the Ducati Cup. Come back and win the title. Just do it.
I can't be the nearly man anymore.
No. The time's there, mate. It's now or never. So we'll go Stock 1000. We'll go to the Ducati Cup, whichever way it is. We wish
Cheers,
you all
mate.
The best.
Thanks very much, Stock Man. Cheers, mate. Thank you.